Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today I have three shorter interviews with authors. The first is Louise Dietzel. She's a family counselor. Next will be Steve Pribram telling us about marriage and money. And then Dr. Sylvia Nosworthy. She's a professor and author of children's books. We're talking with Louise Dietzel, who is a clinical mental health counselor in the States. She's a licensed psychologist master. She's written a book called Parenting with Respect and Peacefulness. You're talking in your book about, well, the title, Parenting with Respect and Peacefulness. You mean not all parents have respect and peacefulness in their home with their children?
Well, their intentions, Dwight, are to have respect and peacefulness. However, sometimes there's a discrepancy between our intentions and between what really happens. So we need to make it more conscious for parents to let them know that it is possible and it's hard work and it takes effort and that they really can create an atmosphere of respect and peacefulness, because that's what helps kids and parents to function a lot better, and it allows the love that the parents have to really flow out to their children.
Well, Louise, what is the key of respecting your children?
The main key, it's not the exclusive key. The main key is to have God's love in their heart and to know that God's love is in their heart, and to know that that's the best way that they teach their children to be loving people in the world, and to teach the gospel of love that we believe in so deeply and that our Bible tells us about and teaches us about. So parents have to have that love that our God gives us so freely in their hearts.
Many times, though, parents are deeply concerned about their children respecting them, but you're turning this around a little bit.
I'm turning the tables, totally turning the tables. Our children are here for us to teach them, not for them to teach us. Now, one of the side benefits and fringe benefits in the parent-child relationship is that we do learn a lot from our children. However, the way it's supposed to be is we are supposed to be here for our children to teach them, to support them, love them, teach them how their behavior affects other people, teach them to have control over their life, and to live a loving life. And oftentimes, you're right, the tables do get turned.
Now, one thing that you mention in your book that I find intriguing, and I want you to speak to that a little bit, is before we can teach respect or even expect respect from our children, you mention and spend quite a bit of time talking about respecting yourself.
Yes, it all starts within ourselves, I believe. I believe that it's impossible for us to teach something that we do not know. Whatever we really know deeply, what we've experienced, what we struggle with, what we have a desire to learn to know more about, is what we are then able to teach, mainly by our behavior to our children. So it's got to begin within us. And I know that there are a lot of other psychologists and mental health professionals that don't always take that viewpoint, and yet in my work, in my own personal relationship with my children, and also in my clinical work, I just find that when people know more what's in their heart, what's in their minds, what they really truly want, then that's what will come out.
One of the chapters in your book talks about respectful communication in the parent-child relationship. What does that mean?
Well, again, it goes back to the parent creating an atmosphere of respect. We need to keep looking at the bigger picture, that when there's an attitude of respect, that then whatever needs to be communicated, and parents need to be real clear, it cannot be a knee-jerk reaction. We need to be mindful and thoughtful about what the words are that are coming out of our mouths, because as all of us know, words are very powerful, and they can either hurt or they can heal, they can tear down or they can build up. And in that chapter of respectful communication, I just talk about how important those words are. And if we can just take a few minutes, or even a moment, or sometimes it's just a split second, to stop and think about, what do I want to come out of my mouth? What is the message that I want my child or my children to receive from the words that come out of my mouth? It takes a lot less time in the short run to think about what that impact might be in the long run.
Now again, often parents are concerned about children who are talking back to them disrespectfully. The words the children use to us or speaking in a manner that we feel they shouldn't to parents. Again, your emphasis seems to be on the parents.
It has to be on the parents. The parents are the adults. They're really the ones who are in charge of the situation and hopefully in charge of themselves. Because what I keep observing over and over and over, and I think this is true in a very universal, worldwide way, is that the children will follow suit with the adults and will truly learn from the adults. And it takes a lot of courage for a child to say, you know, I want this atmosphere to be less argumentative, less stressful, more relaxed, more peaceful. And once in a while, children do that. And yet, by and large, the adult is the adult. Whether they are the adult developmentally, chronologically, they are the adult. And the buck stops with them. They are the responsible one.
So if there is in the home disrespect and things, what I'm hearing you say is that the parent needs to take charge, but instead of blaming the child, instead of getting angry, they need to look within and work on what is going on inside of them as far as their own self-attitude, and then start listening to what is coming out. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Yeah, absolutely. What is going on inside of me and what is coming out? And then because the parent-child is such a personal, very intimate one, there is something that we will invite from our children. And I believe in a primary relationship, which is the spouse-spouse relationship and also the parent-child relationship, as opposed to secondary relationships outside of the family, that everything that, by and large, that comes out of our mouth, our nonverbal, our behavior, we are inviting something from the other person. And I believe that as we get an order to it and say the most primary dimension, and here again, it's not exclusive of other dimensions and other traits and characteristics in the parent-child-adult-child relationship. The primary dimension is that either we are inviting closeness or we are inviting distance. And when children behave in ways that can be described as disrespectful or rude or obnoxious, oftentimes the parent is helping to perpetuate that, even though the parent might not be aware of that, by the way that the parent is talking, the words, the ways of relating to the child. When the parent takes a careful, even sometimes painful look at what am I exuding? What am I putting out? What am I inviting? Oftentimes, as the parent makes those changes, the child will follow suit. children are very adaptable and very resilient.
I'm talking with Louise Dietzel, who is a psychologist and a family counselor. Her book is Parenting with Respect and Peacefulness. We'll be back in just a moment. Louise, you have in your book five parenting tools: praise, affirmation, encouragement, criticism, and judgment. How does that work out in an actual day-to-day parent-child relationship?
Well, first, Dwight, it's that when parents are relating to their children, which they are all the time, just like when they're fixing a leaky faucet underneath the sink, you need to have the right tools, and you have to know what the tools do. Now, you might be able to get by with something that is kind of close in terms of a tool. However, I believe that we can never be too fine-tuned in understanding how we relate to our children. So sometimes we use praise, and praise focuses in a general way on basically what the children do. The child ties his shoe or draws a nice picture. Praise says, "That's very, very nice. I like that." Then there are times when nothing turns out. There isn't a product, there isn't achievement that we can say, "That's a good job." And so we need to fine-tune it a little bit and look at the effort that it took to keep attempting, to keep practicing. So the tool of affirmation says, good practice. Thanks for hanging in there. Thanks for being patient. It's some of those personal traits that all of us learn. Sometimes we call them virtues. And so affirmation focuses on those traits that need to be in place, like the practice, to be able to do a skill well. Encouragement focuses on what all of us need. All of us need a good cheerleader to say, yeah, the going's rough right now, and keep hanging in there. I believe in you. I love you. I'm on your side. I'm on your team, even when the whole team isn't winning. And then criticism and judgment, I needed to talk about those because those are two tools that often, like I mentioned earlier, are from the knee-jerk reactions. They don't come from parents who think about how everything that I do has the potential to affect my child and to either build my child up or to model what it's about to be a wonderful, loving person here in this world. And judgment just tears down when you think about it. There's so much judgment in our world, so many judgment words that are used in our vocabulary. And so I just encourage parents, here again, it's the awareness, it's the fine-tuning, having the right tool to know that what is the job that you want to do? What is the lesson that you want to teach? What is the message that you want to get across? And when you die, what do you want to be remembered? How do you want to be remembered? Do you want to be remembered as the parent who was encouraging and who used praise and was affirming during the rough times? Or are you going to be remembered as that critical, judgmental parent who you just couldn't do anything right for my parent, and then I grew up just feeling awful and inadequate?
Louise, I appreciate you being with us. Thank you, and I hope we can talk again.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Steve Pibram is the author of the best-selling book, Marriage and Money. Steve, why do marriages have so many problems centered around money?
85% of all married households across the country cannot sit down at their own kitchen table, look each other in the eye, and have a 20-minute conversation about the financial issues of the married household.
Mm-hmm. 85%.
That's 85%.
They just can't do it, and when they try to do it, it's a lot of heat and very little light.
Right. A lot of problem, a lot of conflict, a lot of frustration comes rolling out, and oftentimes it ends up in a fight.
Why is that? I mean, it seems like here's another opportunity we could talk about something that we have in common or that we don't have in common.
Well, there's two factors involved. One is gender difference. We have a household made of one man, one woman. There's going to be difference there.
Mm-hmm.
We have two people that are unique individuals that came from two different backgrounds. So those are the two primary reasons why there's conflict, because we have a different perspective and we've not sat down to talk about it to have each other understand what the other's perspective is. Most people that are married have tried it early on in the marriage to talk about money issues.
Mm-hmm.
It breaks out into a great big fight, so they make a pact with each other, either a verbal or nonverbal pact. Hey, because it breaks out into a fight, because we fight every time that we talk over money, let's just not bring up that subject.
Mm.
We won't talk over money, therefore we won't fight. And they think that's the better way to do it, and that's the wrong direction to go.
Hmm. I mean, that's got to be a mistake. To not talk about it is to set yourself up for some kind of problem. What if, let's say that my spouse and I, that we have this pact. We want peace, so we don't talk money. What kind of problems could that get us into?
Well, just insurmountable problems, because the little things that you feel about what your partner does with their money that they have access to, you begin to build a little bit of frustration. After a while, that frustration is like a little pebble, grows into a marble, grows into a boulder. Now, all of a sudden, the dishwasher breaks. Now you have to talk about money. All this information you've built up for 18 months just comes bounding out with power and energy, and it works out into a great big fight. So if you don't wait for 18 months between talking it over, if you talk it over, come to an understanding about it, you're going to be far better off. A lot of times couples will come together if the dishwasher breaks. They'll talk over money issues just long enough to fix the dishwasher, and then they're back to their own private agenda as to what they want to do with money, and they're not working together.
Mm.
The whole science of a relationship, the whole benefit of a relationship, is being able to work together to encourage each other toward common goals.
To encourage each other, talking together, and money, instead of being an instrument that brings division, what you're saying is money becomes an instrument that really draws us closer together.
Especially when we're connected, because we've talked it over, we understand each other's needs, we understand each other's wants, dreams, and desires. When it gets that deep and we have that grade of understanding, it works a lot better. And that we then start setting some goals, 1, 2, 3, 4, on paper, and we set them as 3-year goals, and we start working together toward those same common goals. That's where you have a close and great relationship. You plan some quiet time for 15 minutes. You try to sit down and have a conversation about money. You don't need to leap right into the bills, but you just sit down and try to say, okay, now let's try to talk over our money ideas. What, we have money coming in, what should it be utilized for? What should we be doing with it? Have more of an open conversation about it. Let's get all the cards out. Let's figure out the direction the household wants to go.
Steve Pybram on Money and Marriage. I'm talking with Dr. Sylvia Nosworthy. She's a professor at Walla Walla University, and she has a PhD in curriculum and instruction. And Dr. Nosworthy, thank you for being on LifeQuest magazine. Starting right out, what is your field of study?
My specialty was children's literature and young adult literature.
And is that a wide field?
There are a number of people who teach in this field. It's also one that's populated by librarians, more librarians than teachers sometimes.
The goal of your field of study would be what?
My goal is to have teachers, future teachers, exposed to as many kinds of literature as they can be, so that they're aware of what's out there and so that they're excited about something that they read and
mm-hmm.
they can share that with their students.
And so when you say children, what age group would we be talking about?
In any age group.
All right.
I have preschool teachers all the way up through high school teachers.
What created this interest in you personally?
I think what created it was my childhood. One of the first things I can remember is going to the library and getting books to read, or books that were little French readers or
mm-hmm.
something else like that. My mother read to me extensively, and one of my best times was going to the library.
Has your own experience kind of set an understanding that maybe this is exactly what parents should be doing?
It certainly worked for me. I enjoyed reading tremendously then. I enjoy reading now, and it's one of the things that I still do for pleasure.
Now, as you look at what is available, is there enough for children in the field of literature?
It's a really exciting time because not only are there many, many new books coming out, but there are also many classics that are getting reissued because people are looking again at some of the classics from the past, and because paperback printing is inexpensive, we're getting a lot of classics reissued. And so there's a great deal of wonderful literature out there available for children.
There is a lot of discussion in today's societies, Dr. Nosworthy, about core values and family values. What part does your academic interest play in the development of these values?
If the children are getting read to every day, that develops a bond between parent and child. And there are so many books these days that emphasize family values, some of them that are different from what we might have expected in years past. One of my favorite books is a book called The Wednesday Surprise by mm-hmm. Eve Bunting. And in that book, there is a story about a granddaughter and a grandmother who practice reading, and all the way through you think that it's the granddaughter who's learning to read. In fact, the granddaughter is teaching the grandmother how to read for the first time. And it shows that, you know, there are all sorts of ways of promoting family and family values.
In a variety of world societies, there is such an increased interest in television, in videos. It must be interesting for you to see a renewed interest in reading.
It's exciting. And there are a number of cases also where children are seeing videos of books that they've read, and sometimes seeing the places they've read about, and so that makes an enhanced reading experience as well.
Have you had some opportunities to interact with cultures outside of North America where you're teaching at this time?
I traveled about 5 years ago through Great Britain. I traveled in Europe before that, but in Great Britain I had an experience where I was able to do a lot of research on children's books and also on some of the Arthurian legends, and I visited places that were associated with Beatrix Potter, who's always one of the classics for writing than the many other classics that she mm-hmm. wrote. Also went on a walking tour following some of the places that appear in Winnie the Pooh by A.A. Milne. I also spent 4 years in Korea and did a lot of traveling in Asia, visited Japan several times, Taiwan a couple of times, and one long trip to Thailand, Singapore, and the Philippines. And all of those places, I tried to collect children's books that would show similarities and values that people have in common, and sometimes things that are different in different cultures.
In some non-Western cultures, oral tradition has been very powerful and very strong, and that now seems to be going into print. This seems to be very helpful to keep people in touch with their past.
It's very interesting. The oldest Cinderella story is really a Chinese story, and it travels all around the world, so you have Cinderella stories in all sorts of different cultures, European cultures, Native American cultures, Asian cultures. There's a Korean Cinderella, a Vietnamese Cinderella, and so it's interesting to trace the story all around the world and see what things are important and how they appear in different stories and different cultures. I teach a class in ethnic and minority literature during the summer for teachers, and for those teachers, I provide them with books from many, many different cultures so they can see similarities and they can see variety and they can see some of the values that we don't necessarily have in the United States that maybe we should go back to.
Now, you're a Christian, teaching, in fact, at a Christian university. What is the place, or is there a place, for spiritual values in general children's literature?
I think there's certainly a place for spiritual values. One of the kinds of values that you see expressed in many cultures that we seem to have lost in the United States is the idea of the extended family and valuing family members, even when they're distant relatives. Learning to cooperate, because many American children are taught to be independent and not to work together. But particularly books that promote the fruits of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience, and things like that, kindness and goodness and gentleness, those sorts of things are important in any culture, and you can find them in many different sources. It doesn't necessarily have to be a Christian publisher.
Dr. Nosworthy, I'd like to thank you for taking time and being with us today.
You're very welcome.
I'm Dwight Lainhoff. Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net or write to LifeQuest at P.O. Box 33082, Knoxville, Tennessee 37930.